So Susie is a member of the Snohomish County Surface Water Management Stewardship and Education Team. And this group works on a voluntary basis with citizens to improve water quality, enhance aquatic habitat, and prevent damage due to flooding. And she manages the Watershed Education Program, which includes programs for both youth and adults. And the program offers workshops designed specifically for teachers, as well as classroom presentations and school field trips for students. Has worked with more than 600 teachers and several thousand students across Snohomish County. And the other half of Susie's program is designed to affect behavior change in homeowners, and that's the topic of today's presentation. And she's worked in the surface water management field since 1991. And in 2000, she was honored by the Northwest Aquatic and Marine Educators as the Outstanding Educator of the Year. And she holds a Bachelor of Science degree from Oregon State University, where her major was in landscape architecture. So today she'll tell us about changing societal norms to improve water quality, getting the masses to choose fish and water friendly action. Susie.
Okay, thanks. Hi. So I'm interested in who my audience is today. If your field of study or your profession is maybe in the water field, oh, sorry, you can raise your hand twice, that's okay, I'm not counting that closely. Engineering, biology, fish biology, hydrology, any educators in the room? Yay. So, what have I missed?
Public policy.
Public policy?
Environment.
Environmental studies? Okay, great, thank you. So, did the handouts get around most of the way? Okay. So, I know this is a little bit of a different topic from what is mostly on the agenda.
They're all different topics, so don't worry.
But I think most of them are a little bit more on the hard science, biology, engineering flavor, as I was looking back at the old programs. My colleague, Dave Ward, came and talked more than a year ago, I think, and I think he was probably the last one that was talking on something close to this, kind of education end of things. So I'm really glad to see everybody here. So let's just jump in. So I should have asked about this first.
You could just use your finger on the switch here. Yeah, that should do it.
Okay.
That's a laser. There, it says laser. If you want
okay.
To point. Okay. Yeah.
So, this is the four things that are on the slides, the handouts that went around, and this is going to be a bit of an eclectic talk today. I'm going to be covering a lot of different things, a lot of different theories and models, but not in great depth for any of them. But it's a little bit of a journey of what I've discovered by guess and by golly along the way in my career in education. And I wish that I had a talk like this at the beginning so someone could have told me, you don't have to go through all this stumbling around. Here's some people who have actually researched these things, and here's the answers. So, Bennett's model.
So there's no way for me to forward this from using this dealie?
Let me see if it actually does it. I can't remember how to do it. No, I think you'll have to come back and do it. Sorry.
So, when I started in education years ago, I came from more of a school background, a public school type background of education. And without really about it, it turns out that the education and the things that work in a public school or private school in elementary and high school is really fundamentally different than what you need to do when you're doing environmental ed and trying to get behavior change. And I'll show you how that is. And this is also kind of an important point for the bulk of you in this room who you know, are the engineers, the foresters, the scientists, the biologists. If I were to ask most of you at this time or last week, you know, what do you think the role of education is in your line of work? You know, I think you'll see yourselves on the slide, and it's kind of like halfway. So let's jump into this. So the traditional environmental ed programs really used to think that if people just knew more, if they had more factoids in their heads, then surely they would do the right things. And those of us in the natural resources professions kind of sat around and kind of wondered, like, well, why isn't the general public doing the right thing yet? Maybe they just don't know enough. And so the programs are really just knowledge-based and squeezing more factoids into people's heads. Here's some examples. If people just knew more, they'd make more salmon-friendly decisions. If they knew that car wash runoff and all that pollution was leading to problems in creeks and it was bad for fish, people would do something different. They'd make a better choice. So it turns out that isn't enough, and I'll show you why.
So again, this is kind of the model that we used to just assume worked, but it doesn't. And so here's why. And this is the first slide in the handout that you guys got. Back in the mid-70s, Mr. Bennett was with Cooperative Extension, and he came up with this model for evaluating environmental ed programs. And he thought about it and said, at different stages along the way, there are outcomes and things that you can count. But it depends on what you're counting and how far up this continuum you're getting, when you're actually going to get changes on the ground. So if you see down here resources, activities, participants, reactions, knowledge, that's where traditional public schools get to. And that's their job. You know, for the most part, they're not training public schools, private schools, elementary, high schools. They're not training people to go out and necessarily to literally save fish and get cleaner water. And maybe they should be doing it more, but they're not. So basically, the traditional school gets you up through knowledge. Mr. Bennett really recognized that in order to get again on-the-ground things, behavior change, cleaner water, more fish, better habitat, we really needed to get farther up on this ladder. So let me just give you some examples. And one of the really neat things about Venice is I'm using today as an example of really, when I learned about this, it was one of those eye-opening moments for me that, my job isn't just to get factoids into people's heads. It's really, I really should be looking at the end result. And that was just kind of an eye-opener for me years and years ago. So, again, I just wanted to share that with you. We've got programs have resources, which for the most part is money that allows you to hire staff and buy supplies and equipment. Then you can have different activities. You can have classes and workshops. You can take people out in the field. Those are all those things that, and again, along the way, you can count and measure those. You offered 10 different classes over the year. So again, things you can count. You can, how much money is in your budget. When you offer those activities, you have participants like today, 100 and whatever people there are here. Then, along the way, people should have, they're going to have a reaction one way or the other to whatever is presented. If they fall asleep on you, that's one reaction. If they get up and leave, hopefully, they're going to really get jazzed up by what you're saying.
And if they stay awake and stay in the room, maybe you're going to get a few bits of information into their heads. But where you really need to go beyond that, if you want to get changes on the ground, is that they need to be in agreement with what you're basically saying. And the other thing that environmental ed program managers really need, have a responsibility to do, is to provide an opportunity for those people to try something new. We can wave our arms and give people lists of things to do that are fish friendly and will improve habitat, but if people don't actually do those things, nothing's going to change. And this is again where some of the traditional programs really fell short. It's actually incredibly hard to get people to try something for the first time. People don't like change. It's scary for most people, even though we may not admit it. And then you also need to really think about what's going to motivate the masses to decide to try something new. And that's tricky. There's, you know, the social science comes in there. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But if you get all those things to happen, then you've got a chance at getting behavior change. And in environmental ed, it's hard to, say, have a program that is going to, say, reduce fecal coliform in a creek in a neighborhood, and then to be able to actually measure, go out and measure the water and find less fecal coliform. That's kind of hard to do. That's very dependent on weather and a lot of other things. So in my area, really what we're hoping for is if we can get consistent behavior change, and we know that we're working on a BMP that's been established, then we have to assume you're going to get the end result you want sooner or later. But it's tricky because oftentimes it takes a few years to actually see the actual end result. But if you don't have it in mind, you're really liable to go straying off someplace else. So there's the model again. And just a reminder, this is, you know, when I started, this is kind of what I was, you know, I was really glad if I got people to show up to an event. That was, you know, a good day. So I just want to share with you, this is actually a class that Snohomish County used to do. And, you know, we had money, we had activities. This class is called Watershed Keepers. And it was one night a week for 10 different weeks, and we had some weekend field trips. And so we had 40 contact hours with people. And, you know, people were giving up a lot of time to come to the class. When we advertised, we put new ads in the newspapers. We got people from all over the county to come. It was like $20. So it was a really inexpensive class. And the people who signed up for it, you know, we usually get 25 or 30 people, and they were really energetic citizens, and they were really the people you love to work with. They were really enthusiastic, and you know, they wanted to be part of the solution. They were really concerned about water issues, and they wanted to know, you know, what can I do? That just give me instructions, and I'll go out and do something good. So getting a positive reaction out of that group was pretty easy. But we did ask people at the end of each class, and we do the traditional evaluations and have them tell us, you know, how the speaker was versus the topic. Because that's another thing that, you know, think about. You can have a really interesting topic presented by a bad speaker or vice versa. And then we actually gave before and after quizzes to people at the very beginning of the 10-week session and at the end. What was interesting is at the very beginning, on the natural resource type questions about water and fish and habitat things, people came into the class knowing a whole lot already. I mean, 80% or so of their responses were correct. The class also covered a lot of social and political issues, like how to go and actually find a county code or a state law, how to look those things up. What is the process for going before the county council and testifying, those types of things. So that kind of process, the social science stuff, they didn't know as much about, which did surprise me. I was surprised to know that they already knew so much about natural resources coming in. But so, you know, we proved that we jammed a lot of information that I had. The scores increased. But when we followed people, you know, 2 or 3 years later, the first class or two at least, what we discovered was, even though they had a lot of knowledge, this is what I was just telling you, even though they had a lot of knowledge in their heads, they weren't able, and even though these were really gung-ho people, they still weren't doing a lot of things after the class. They weren't taking actions that would be fish and watershed friendly. So, we, you know, this is about the time when I discovered Venice model, and I kind of analyzed the program and said, you know, here's what we're missing. So, again, agreement with that group was pretty easy. But what I was saying before, we weren't giving them, we were just giving them the list of new skills. Here's a bunch of things you can try. What we found out is we really needed, even with these gung-ho people, we literally had to set up a situation and literally hold their hands and walk them through the first time. And then, again, doing something once is not behavior change. I mean, that's kind of the difference between test driving a car and actually buying it. Big difference. But even just getting people to actually do something once, even in, you know, a very controlled setting, was something that we knew we had to at least go that far. Motivation, again, for this group in the Watershed Keeper class wasn't too hard because they came in already motivated. But what I kind of along the way is, again, you know, people are creatures of habit, and most of us don't like change. The other thing I found working with my coworkers is, you know, those of us in the natural resources fields, we tend to think that what motivates us to want to change, you know, people in my office are not like the average person on the street. So what motivates us, and probably a lot of you in this room, is not the same thing that's going to motivate the average person on the street, you know, the majority of the population. So, you know, if for a lot of people in this room, apart from a lot of my coworkers, you know, just knowing what the right thing is, and we just do what's good for the resource, is our area of work. But for people on the street, maybe it's financial. Maybe it has to be cheaper or easier for them to do what we want them to do. And so just this idea that every person is going to be motivated, or these groups of people are going to have totally different motivations. So as an educator, don't sit there in your shoes and try to expect everybody to be motivated by what you want them to do. Figure out, you really need to sit in their shoes and say, okay, what is it that's going to get them to do what I want them to do? And I'll give you a few examples of that later on, too. And a lot of times, for the average person, it is money. It's got to be really easy or it's got to be really inexpensive. So, even though I don't have a lot of time today, I did want to kind of veer off topic for just a moment while I'm talking about Venice, because Venice really was actually designed as an evaluation tool, and I'm not talking about evaluation today, but since I've got you guys thinking about Venice, I just did want to share that with you. On the handout, there's a web page, and Venice is also known as TOTS. And if you go in there, there's a really nice, pretty easy to read paper that talks about how to use Venice as an evaluation tool. Because I think that's actually really, really valuable. Not just for education programs, but probably has lots of other applications too. And just to, you know, another thing I've kind of learned along the way, there's a lot of programs, education programs and other programs, that just don't get evaluated at all. And I think in this day and age, where money is really tight and things are getting cut left and right, if your program isn't evaluated by you in some formal way, you're really leaving yourself at risk. So you should evaluate. And even though it's sometimes not really fun, I think you owe it to yourself and your program. So there's different things you can look at, and this kind of lines up with Venice, but you can, you know, some people only evaluate, did you meet your budget? You know, did you spend right up to the limit but not go over? And maybe that's a sign of success. You can count the numbers of people that came. These are all things that can easily be evaluated. And so if you don't, you're just, you're foolish.
And I guess my last little note on evaluation is that even if you don't evaluate your program, other people are going to be evaluating it in some form or fashion. So an example might be that you've got a great program. It's doing exactly what you wanted, what the stated objectives were. But let's say there's an accident, some crew's out there and they get ruined, and it's not even their fault. But that may be the thing that the funders remember about your program is, that's the group that had the accident. Budget time, there you go. So if you don't have numbers and things to evaluate to show what your program really did, again, you're kind of leaving yourself open. So the next thing I wanted to throw out there is a theory called diffusion of innovation. And this is something that marketers look at a lot. The people who are selling cell phones and cars and that sort of thing. They're segmenting the audience all the time, and they have, just like we do, they have limited ad dollars, and so they're going to put them where they're most effective. So this model has been out there for decades. It's just that the environmental ed community has just picked it up probably in the last 10 years or so. But what it does, for me as an educator, when I discovered this, it really freed me up. I used to think that I needed to get to everybody out there. 700 and some thousand people that live in Snohomish County. That was kind of a daunting task. But there's actually a way to chop that down a bit. So here's what the picture looks like of diffusion. And so what I think about is
if you think of the people in kind of the orange and yellow side of the curve, those people they're the ready and willing and they're really excited about doing the thing that you want them to do already. So if you just give them a little nudge, they'll fall downhill pretty easily. Whereas working with the people on the blue and the gray side, those people are just harder to move. You literally have to push them uphill first before they get over the hump and are doing what you want. So,
work smart. Work with the people. There's half the population's over there ready and willing. So focus on them first. So here's a kind of a profile of the innovators. So there's, on the average community, 2.5% of the people will be innovators. And these folks,
they might be almost seen as oddballs by a lot of people because they're out there. They're probably taking from the average person's point of view, they're probably taking unnecessary risks and doing things. They tend to have enough money so that if their little gamble doesn't quite pay off, no big deal. They're people who can kind of connect all the dots pretty quickly and apply some new technology or new strategy. You think of all the tycoons and moguls of the 20s and 30s that jumped into the railroad and things like that. And in later generations, the Bill Gateses and people who jumped into the technology age. They were probably in this category. Again, not too many people in that group.
So early adopters,
these are kind of the Joneses. These are the people that a lot of us want to copy, want to be like. So they're really well integrated into their community, into society. People really respect their opinion. And again, they tend to have enough financial resources. And again, about 13-14% of the population. So,
a bigger group. But here's where, about a third of the people in any community are going to be. They're going to be the early majority. So they're never going to be the first people with the new gadgets.
But they're watching the people who have the gadgets, and it looks like, yeah, that's, you know, that new cell phone, I think I'm going to get one of those, you know, in a month or so. That's kind of what they're thinking.
Another third of the people are the late majority. So these are the people now that are on the back side of the curve. So from an education purpose, I usually don't worry too much about these people because I have to push them up over the hump to get them to do what I want. And sooner or later, you know, a good portion of this group will come along and do what the early people were doing, and they'll do it for free. I mean, to me, I don't have to pay to get them to do whatever that behavior is. So these are a lower priority for me as an educator. And then there's the laggards. These folks are really, they're just totally off my radar screen. To try to use education on this group is a really expensive process, if it will even work at all. So Nancy Lee is someone that does a lot of social marketing. That her book is kind of one of the Bibles. I borrowed this slide from her. She talks about people in terms of how green or sprouts, or if they're brown. So this kind of lines up with the diffusion curve. And she even has people who are like, the innovators aren't really on her chart, on this chart, but she calls those people the really bright greens. So there's the chart again. So just to sum up, from an education point of view, when we're doing programs and trying to get behavior change, what I'm looking for is I'm trying to find the early adopters in the community, you know, the Joneses that people are, that they want to follow. And then I'm also looking for the early majority. So that's you know, a pretty good chunk of the population. And for the most part, I don't, you know, I run into innovators every once in a while, but I don't go out looking for them. They seek me out. That's their personality. But again, lots of the people in the early majority, especially, they look at them as a little bit off. They're kind of kooks almost. So I don't look to those people to be setting the examples. Again, the laggards. This is where in education, it's really nice when you can be paired up in your organization with some enforcement arm, because the laggards, that's what they need. I mean, they need a law that says you must do that, otherwise they're just not gonna move. They're the people who need the sticks, and you need to sometimes hit them with a stick every once in a while if they're not doing what they're supposed to. And again, education just is, just, you're wasting your money on the laggards with education programs. So, again, I told you I'm going to throw in a lot of things at you. So this is kind of the third topic today. The outreach continuum. The history on this is our group that I work with within Sonoma County Surface Water Management is the Outreach and Stewardship and Education Group. And I know I'm really lucky because I'm in an organization that's big enough that we have that depth. And I know that a lot of the smaller cities, they might have one person and half of their job is to do what our whole group of six or seven does. So I know I'm really in a very good position that way. But what we do is we sat down some years ago and said, so if we were to draw a picture of what it is that we do in our group, you know, what does it look like? And this is what we came up with. We drew it as a pyramid. We put the things that, over here on the right-hand side, all the different types of activities that we offer to citizens in Snohomish County. So, you know, we place articles in the paper. We go to fairs and stand at booths. We send out newsletters. We have information on the web. So all that stuff is relatively inexpensive, but it's very impersonal.
But for people who just want to know a little bit about surface water, they don't have to call and talk to us if they don't want to. They can get that information anonymously. So that's the awareness stage. We also have, you know, the work that I usually do, which is the classes and the workshops, things like that. So people who want to actually learn something. And then if, as you move up, we have watershed stewards who are available to go out. They do site visits on people's property. They give them advice on how to improve you know, their stream side vegetation. If there's erosion going on, they'll explain, you know, why it's eroding and what they should, what they can do to kind of stop that. So as you move up the pyramid, what you get is you go from really high numbers of people that we can contact, but we don't know them very well, or we don't know them at all, to I know people where and I see them at two or three workshops, and I get to know their names, I recognize their face, I kind of know probably generally what stream they live on or near, but I don't know the names of their dogs, their kids, and stuff like that. But the stewards, they make repeated visits with people because they're working on bigger projects, and they do to get to know, you know, the birthdays of all the people in the household and the names of all the dogs and, you know, which dogs like to fetch and that sort of stuff. So it's low numbers of people that our stewards are working with, but by the time a citizen calls up and wants to work with a steward, I mean, you can almost guarantee that they're going to do, you know, really do something on their property that's beneficial for fish and water. Whereas if you take the people that we meet at the fair, and we have maybe a display about low-impact development strategies, most of them are going to, you know, they're at the fair for the rides or the scones or something like that, and they just happen to pop into our booth. It may be the first time they've ever heard about low-impact development strategies and maybe rain gardens or things like that. So, you know, you can't expect somebody to come in to a fair and then the next day to go out and start building a rain garden. You know, that's not going to happen. But by the time, again, if someone asks for a steward visit, they probably have maybe come to one of the workshops that I've hosted, or they've really gone to our web page and studied things on their own. And so they're, you know, they kind of know what they want. So then I've got some very specific questions for the stewards. So anyway, this is kind of the model of what our group does when we drew it. So when we showed it to our division director, she said, well, why is it just like a column? And we literally made it a pyramid because we wanted to show that there's lots and lots of people at the bottom. And in a sense, I mean, we've never actually done it, but there probably is some sort of a mathematical formula. You know, if you get 4,000 people down at the awareness level, that gives you 400 people at the learning level, and, you know, the numbers get smaller as you go up. But that's why it's a triangle. So as it turns out, we didn't know at the time, but what we stumbled into, which was, once again, wish we'd known that before, but what we stumbled into was a process called stages of change. And this is used an awful lot in healthcare education, community education, like for stopping smoking cessation, or drug and alcohol abuse. Counselors in those fields especially are very aware of this. And usually when you see this chart, it's actually flipped the other way. So I've got what the pre-contemplation, which I've got at the bottom, is normally at the top, and you know, 99, I'm probably the only one who has it upside down like this. But this is the way it matches our continuum. So, if you see in the little letters, I've actually got how the stages of change actually line up perfectly with the little picture that we had drawn. And we had no idea. But again, you know, this is something that's, turns out, very, 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 very well researched and just fascinating. And when you think about things in your own life that you've tried to change, and this might give you some clues, I mean, whether it's in your field or whatever it is. But here, their steps are pre-contemplation, so people aren't even considering doing whatever it is. And again, most of the times this is used in healthcare. So someone has the whole world knows they have a drug or alcohol problem, but they won't admit it, so they're not contemplating any changes. And at some point, people might move up to the contemplation stage and then kind of on up. But you'll see yourself in some of the things that you've probably tried in your own life, or you've made a change. And again, remember I said that just doing something once is not behavior change. That's a test drive. You've really, you know, when people are creating programs to really get behavior change, long-term behavior change, we really need to be looking at, you know, how to help those people take that first action, and then what are the things that we need to do to help them maintain that action? And it, especially in drug and alcohol and smoking, and even in environmental actions, BMPs that we want people to take, there's chances for relapse. This is something our program hasn't really addressed. We're still working on the middle stuff, but that's something that we're, you know, we talked about it.
So, real quickly,
I'm, again, really lucky that I've got a large enough group. So when I'm doing my workshops and classes, I'm always thinking, so, you know, where does the citizen live? Which steward am I going to nudge them up to? Because, you know, my job is to nudge them up closer to the top of that pyramid. That outreach continuum is a really good thing for budgeting also. We've been able to show that to our managers and explain to them that, you know, when people are learning to walk, they don't just, you know, they're not a baby, on a one-month-old baby, and they don't just start walking. You know, you have to crawl, and you toddle, and you walk, and then you run. So doing behavior change is the same thing. We have to have a program that has all those stages, little steps along the way for people to jump onto. The next thing is that if you don't happen to have in your organization the means to have all those different steps for people, you need to take an inventory and see kind of where are your programs on that continuum and figure out, do you want to change your program so that you have every step for citizens, or do you want to partner up with another agency or nonprofit, let's say, who is an expert in some of the areas that you're missing. And really, that's probably a better way to go. If they're already doing something. And the other thing, from a grant writing perspective, grantors love it when you partner up with somebody. So there you've got this natural partnership where you're handing people off to doing a tag team.
And you get extra points in your grant. So, I'm going to really cruise through this. Social marketing is the last thing I wanted to talk about, but even in here, I was really going to do it injustice. So let me just say that.
Again, Nancy Lee, and there's several other people who have written about social marketing, but this is a strategy for getting people to do something voluntarily, usually, things that there just aren't ever going to be laws that are going to make people do things. Or if there are laws, they're kind of types of laws which are really hard to enforce. So here's just a few examples. So, you know, healthcare people want our diets to be better. So they want us to eat five fruits and vegetables a day. So there's a great social marketing campaign to get people to do that. And again, that's not something that's ever going to be legislated. You know, we're not going to be ever required to eat that many vegetables. But some of these are legal things, like moving right. You probably can get you can get a ticket for it, but the likelihood is pretty low. Anyway, so
social marketing. This is, again, it's a lot of similar parts of the program when you're planning a social marketing campaign, very similar to planning a commercial campaign for, you know, McDonald's burgers or whatever. But the goal is different. And in Nancy's book, she spells out, it's a great book, really great example, so I highly recommend, if this is at all fascinating to you, to get a copy of her book. But if you're going to do a program, you really do need to go through all the steps. But I guess in just the last few minutes here, to me, the most important parts are to really sit down and think about your target market. You know, who is it that you're going to try to get to do whatever the behavior change is? And once you've got that target group figured out, then really talk to those people, do some focus groups, informal or formal, and find out, you know, what is it that's going to motivate them? That goes back to the Bennett's model. You know, what's going to motivate those people to change? And again, it's probably not going to be the same thing that motivates you. So these days, whenever I see someone say that they're going to do something for the general public, I just kind of go, oh my goodness, you know, they've got a big job and they're not going to do it very well because they haven't really targeted their audience. So those are a couple examples. I think I'm just going to wrap it up here and open it up for questions. So there's what we sped through today.
Questions?
Yeah. So when you did your small groups or focus groups, and it looked like you started to address it on the other side, what did you find was going to get people to do what you needed to do, whether it's pet waste or go to commercial car wash? And I think it might have been on the
Well, yeah, so let me just, since you ask, let me go back to that for a sec.
Repeat the question so people
can hear. When we did our focus groups, what did we find that what was going to move the people and convince them or get them to do what we wanted? So Snohomish County does have a really neat pet waste program that one of my colleagues worked on. And so what we wanted less fecal coliform in the streets. That was our goal as surface water managers. But when we talked to people, we found out that they really don't care. I mean, they do care, but it's not high enough on their priority list. Even if they live right on a creek. But what was important to them was when we told them that, you know, there's roundworms, there's threadworms, there's all kinds of other parasites and bacteria in that poop, and when you leave it in your yard and then your kids play in it, you know, some of that stuff can linger there for months. That grossed people out, and they thought, okay, that's going to get me to pick up my dog waste more often. So if you look at our campaigns, there's all kinds of things that show kids playing in yards, and we're talking about their health, not the health of the creek. I mean, in most of our dog waste campaigns, there's nothing in there about water quality. In fact, you know, some people might kind of go, why is surface water management doing this campaign about picking up dog waste? So that was one thing that we learned, and we wouldn't have known that if we hadn't done some focus groups and just asked people. So what we want people to do is our message was, you know, scoop the poop, bag it, toss it in the trash. So when we finally got around to the part of the focus group where we said, okay, this is what we want you to do, one of the really interesting things we found is that there were a lot of people that were picking up the dog waste, and then they were taking it, so here's their garbage can over there where we wanted them to take it. Here, there's their native road protection area, their green belt right along the stream. They didn't want it in their yard. But they were taking it over to their green belt and they're dumping the pet waste, concentrated dog food, right next to the creek. So from a water quality perspective, it would have been better if they just left it in the lawn. But what we realized, we asked them, so why are you doing that? And they said, well, we don't think we're supposed to put it in the trash. You know, we don't want to offend our garbage haulers by putting dog poop in there. So we said, oh, that's interesting. So they had half the behavior. They were picking it up and collecting it. All we needed to do was get them to turn this way and not that way. So we went and we talked to the garbage haulers and said, do you guys care what's in the garbage? They said, we don't care at all. They never look. But, which, you know, if you think about it, it's probably true. So, but what we realized is so many people told us that they didn't want to offend their garbage haulers. So we said, okay, we'll make up. In fact, I brought them for you guys today. Some We Scoop stickers that are designed to go. Hand these out for me. So this can be your reminder of social marketing.
So we designed these to go on garbage cans. So the people who were worried about offending their garbage haulers, at least they were giving them some warning. There's poop inside my garbage can. And that freed people up to put the poop in the garbage can. So that was, we wouldn't have known that if we hadn't talked to people. So that was one big realization. Other questions? Yeah, see you.
Hey, I have a question regarding your stages of change model, which is very specific, but it doesn't really address, even though you mentioned it, it doesn't really address, you know, the a version of the neighborhood pusher, your TV station always providing us a different message and somebody wants to have individuals for behavior change. There's generally this message out there, make everything easier for yourself, give the latest, fastest way of getting results. So all of a sudden, you've got these Cooper Scoopers, for example, and produce one of your things here, which is easier to take care of. Yes, you scoop, but then you'll end up putting it in trash, bags, or in bags that are not going to be degradable. And that's just an example.
Yeah.
We come up with the degradable bags, but then people don't know about it, and there's a whole different message out there saying, well, those are really not biodegradable.
So this is, so the, yeah.
What do you deal with all of that?
So the question and kind of comment is about using biodegradable or not biodegradable plastic bags for poop, for collecting poop. But you know, we had a huge debate in our office about this. But when you collect your dog poop in a plastic bag, it's going to a landfill. If you do what we want you to, if you put it in your garbage, it's going to a landfill. It's not going to degrade no matter what for hundreds of years. So biodegradable isn't really important, I don't think. But what is important is you should buy plastic bags that have a high recycled content in them. But I don't worry whether my bags are biodegradable or not. But marketers market that because people think it's important. But really, truly, if you know enough about solid waste management, it's not a big deal. Yeah.
I think that's really related to the composting, which is done.
I don't want to get into the issue of plastic degradation. It was an example of how do you deal with the many other messages. People want to do good, but they get all these other messages from marketers, from, you know, the latest, greatest.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it was.
Yeah. Well, again, it goes back to doing good market research. You need to find out where, you know, what are the things that are going to trip people up. And you need to, and this is again in one of those 10 steps, which I didn't even, you know, I just flashed them up on the screen. But when you do your designing your social marketing campaign, that's one of the things you really need to think about is what other messages might people get confused about or confuse your message with something else. And there's, you know, you need to test those things out. Again, not probably with your coworkers or the people who are in your field, because people in your field, think just like you. You know, you sort of don't have to ask them. You can ask yourself. But you need to ask, you know, the people that are in the early majority group. Get your focus group of those people. Yeah.
One more question. Does your group have a formal purpose statement?
Good
question.
Does our group have a formal purpose statement? Really. But our division does. The Surface Water Management Division does as a whole.
All right, time's up.
Thank you.
I'm kind of in the middle.